From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, snotites, troglobites, and bat guano, a conversation about the secret life of caves with caver Michael Ray Taylor, author of a new National Geographic book about caves. It's a companion to a new IMAX film. Also, New York Times book critic and former foreign correspondent Richard Bernstein tells us about his experiences retracing the journey of a 7th century Buddhist monk through China and India, and why Bernstein, a secular Jew, single, childless, and uneasy with the idea of home, made the trip. It's the subject of his new book. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. On Capitol Hill, Vice President Cheney cast his first tie-breaking vote today to give Senate Republicans a big win on a Medicare vote. NPR's Julie Rovner reports.
The Senate tied 50-50 on a Republican proposal to effectively double to $300 billion, the amount President Bush set aside in his budget to reform Medicare and add a prescription drug benefit. One Democrat, Georgia's Zell Miller, and one Republican, Rhode Island's Lincoln Chafee, broke ranks with their party on the vote. Democrats charged that the Republican plan, which prevailed after Cheney made the final tally 51-50, would jeopardize the solvency of Medicare's Hospital Trust Fund because it would use the trust fund to pay for the new benefits. But a Democratic alternative that would have provided the extra Medicare funds by reducing the president's proposed $1.6 trillion tax cut failed on an identical 50-50 vote. The vice president didn't vote because Republicans wanted that amendment to fail. Julie Rovner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The United States said today that China should expect no apology over a U.S. spy plane incident. A senior State Department official said the U.S. would regret the loss of the Chinese pilot involved in Sunday's mid-air collision with the U.S. plane, but he said no apology. China has demanded an apology. President Bush said today that diplomats who visited with the spy plane's crew on the Chinese island of Hainan reported no one was injured and all 24 people appear to be in good health.
Our crew members expressed their faith in America, and we have faith in them. They send their love to their families. They said they're looking forward to coming home, and we are looking forward to bringing them home.
The surveillance plane made an emergency landing on Chinese territory after the collision. Another wave of corporate earnings warnings today sent Wall Street staggering. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
For investors, the misery continues with very little in the way of good news to give the beleaguered financial markets a lift. Stocks fell sharply, primarily on expectations that when corporate profit figures begin coming out this week, they will be below expectations. There were also earnings warnings from software manufacturers, including Ariba and Broadvision. According to Thomson Financial First Call, which tracks earnings of the more than 200 technology companies that have pre-announced results so far, more than 80% have issued profit warnings. Analysts also warned investors to brace for lower earnings in the airline sector, saying the 10 major carriers could lose as much as $700 million for the first quarter. It would be the airline industry's first quarterly operating loss in more than 7 years. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average sank 292 points today to close at 9486 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq was down 110 to finish at 1673. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia's president, Vojislav Kostunica, has ruled out sending former president Slobodan Milosevic to the UN War Crimes Tribunal soon. But Yugoslavia says Milosevic may face charges at home that carry the death penalty. Officials say the charges could include ordering the assassination of political rivals. Milosevic is being held at Belgrade's Central Prison for at least a month as authorities try to build a case against him on corruption charges. Some food manufacturers do not identify possible allergic triggers in their products, according to a Food and Drug Administration report. NPR's Joanne Silberner has details.
Millions of people have food allergies. In rare cases, the allergies are severe enough to kill them if they eat the wrong food. Food labels are supposed to list ingredients in full so that these people can protect themselves. But a study by the Food and Drug Administration and state health officials, posted on the internet earlier this year, shows that the labels may not be all that accurate. Inspectors checked 85 food manufacturing plants in Minnesota and Wisconsin and found that nearly 20% produced products containing eggs or nuts or other allergens not listed on the label. The contamination came from equipment used to manufacture other products or from improper cleaning. Many of the plants changed their manufacturing processes or their labeling after being informed of the results. Joanne Silberner, NPR News, Washington.
A man accused of breaking the neck of an airline ticket agent at Newark International Airport has been acquitted. A jury deliberated for 2 days before clearing John Davis of aggravated assault. Davis was accused of slamming a ticket agent head first into the floor. Defense witnesses said the ticket agent attacked first. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from SmartMoney.com, financial advice, analytical tools, and coverage of the financial world. On the web at SmartMoney.com.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Dial Press Division, publisher of Paradise Park by Allegra Goodman, the author of Caterskill Falls.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In an age when everything seems to have been explored, many of the millions of caves hidden beneath the surface of the earth are still uncharted. My guest, Michael Ray Taylor, has been exploring caves since 1979 and has written several books about them. His latest, Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms, is a companion to a new IMAX movie. Taylor describes caving as being in the midst of a golden age of discovery, comparable to the jungle penetrations of the last century or the mountain conquests of Edmund Hillary's day. Because no sunlight penetrates there, caves are inhospitable to most plant and animal life. But exotic life flourishes there, including microorganisms known as extremophiles, because they live in such extreme environments, environments that may be closer to the landscapes of other planets. In fact, NASA is studying cave microorganisms to better understand what life forms on other planets might be like. I asked Taylor to describe some of the unusual characteristics of cave-dwelling microorganisms.
Well, my favorite extremophile, it's not one organism, but it's actually a whole colony of thousands of different organisms. But they live together in a specialized kind of microbial mat that right now is only known in one cave. It's in Mexico. It's called Villa Luz. And these things that grow in the caves, a caver named Jim Pizarrowitz named them snotites. They are, if you can picture your typical stalactite, only instead of being made of rock, it's made of a jelly-like substance that sways in the breeze and drips pure sulfuric acid. These are living curtains, and the acid comes from the poisonous hydrogen sulfide gas in the cave. They use it for food. They convert this hydrogen sulfide gas into acid. The acid drips down, hollows out more cave. So in essence, they've created their own environment. They're the reason the cave exists in the first place. And it's like something from a science fiction movie to walk into a room like this wearing a gas mask, avoiding the acid so it doesn't eat through your clothes, and see that life has adapted.
Is it named after snot? I mean,
yes, it's named after snot. It looked like okay. A big curtain of snot. So the guy who discovered them named them snotites. And the name has stuck. Even in, you know, you get scientific papers now at major universities on snotites.
And what are troglobites?
There are technical definitions between what's a troglobite and what's a troglodyte, and it has to do with life that has that is common on the surface but has somehow adapted to the caves. Some animals live just in the light zone of the caves near the entrance. Others are completely cave-adapted, you know, the famous blind fish that you get in caves in Kentucky and a few other places that have lost their eyes completely. They've lost all their skin pigmentation. They are genetically dependent on life in the cave. Although, interestingly, there was recently a study of a cave in Mexico where the underground river flows past this big opening to the surface. And the blind cavefish in this cave, in this skylit area, have, after who knows how many thousands of generations, have gotten their eyes back. And through genetic analysis of the fish, you can tell they lost them in ancient generations, and in recent generations, they got them back. Most troglobites are like that. They're surface animals that have become cavers, kind of like people. But then the bacteria that I've been studying more recently are dependent on the cave and could not exist anywhere else.
Are scientists speculating that some of these microorganisms in caves might prove useful to people?
Well, some scientists are doing more than speculate. In the same way that scientists go to the rainforest for natural products and, you know, herbal medicines that can be turned into prescription medicines, scientists are studying the chemical properties of these organisms. If you consider the genetic diversity of life on Earth, the bacteria are much more diverse than the larger organisms. That means that any two bacteria in a cave pool are probably much more distant relatives than I am to a corn plant. And when you get that genetic diversity, you get lots of strategies of, this is how I'm going to fight off invaders. So that means lots of new medicines, potentially. There's a guy named Larry Mallory that I've accompanied on several cave collections around the world, and he has a company that's developing drugs from cave organisms. They've had some very promising early results of a particular organism that seems to secrete a chemical that goes after breast cancer. Doesn't harm other types of cancer, doesn't harm healthy cells, but there's something about a breast cancer cell that mimics a natural enemy it has in the cave. And so they are in the long and unfortunately drawn out process of creating and bringing to market a drug based on this. They've also found two or three new types of antibiotics, and with various bacteria that we've been able to treat with antibiotics for much of the 20th century, now suddenly becoming resistant to those antibiotics. We need some new antibiotics to come into the market in the next century, and I think a lot of them may actually come from caves and other extreme environments.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Ray Taylor, and he's the author of the new book, Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms, and it's a companion book to a new IMAX film called Journeys into Amazing Caves. Michael Ray Taylor has been caving for years and is the author of a couple of other books about caves as well. Let's talk a little bit about underwater caves. Just describe one underwater cave that you've been to for us.
Well, in the course of traveling with the IMAX crew, which made the film Journey into Amazing Caves, one of the two stars of the film, Hazel Barton, is a certified cave diver who invited me to accompany her into a collection area that's featured in the film. And this was in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. And the unique thing about these caves as compared to other underwater caves, they're relatively shallow. The water's 30 to 40 feet deep. And the caves were all dry during the last ice age when sea levels were lower. All the water was up in the ice cap. And so they formed the dripstone formations that can grow only in air. You know, beautiful stalactites, draperies, flowstone, stalagmites, columns, and so forth. So these are very well decorated and pretty rooms, which make them great on the IMAX film. But for me as a caver who normally has to do a lot of climbing and crawling and rappelling to get to a place like this, to float through it with dive gear was like being weightless. So it was a wonderful sensation to just glide effortlessly past these wonderful formations, floating along with the lights. Our dive lights would reflect off them in the water in interesting patterns. Just very pretty.
Now, there are certain problems that cavers experience when they're swimming deep under the ground.
Yeah, cave diving is extremely dangerous. It's you know, caving itself is something that almost anybody can do if they're with a good guide and if they have a couple of hours of training prior to going underground. Cave diving, on the other hand, I would no more, without proper training, sit down and try to fly an Air Force jet than I would try to cave dive without proper training, because there are so many ways you can mess up and die. It's that simple. I get lost in caves from time to time. It's the way you get lost in a shopping mall. You have to backtrack your steps a few ways and figure out where you got turned around. But if you have 30 minutes of air on your back and you're lost and it takes you 45 minutes to find your way, then you're not leaving the cave. And there are so many ways to become disoriented, to have a gear failure. You have to be able to deal with any emergency quickly and with a calm head. I go on a lot of trips with cave divers where I haul their tanks into the cave, and I'll get to a certain point and I'll say, well, I'll be the guy waiting for you. I hope you have a good dive. It's extremely dangerous. There's no way around it.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the animal life that you've found in caves. Why don't we start with the most commonly known one, which is bats. You were once in a cave with 40,000 bats?
Well, 40,000 is a conservative number. There were 40,000 in the air around me in that particular passage. I think the cave itself may have had as many as 500,000 bats, and I've been in other caves that have colonies of up to 20 million bats. It is what you would expect it to be as an experience. It's a little creepy. It's a horror movie sort of sensation when they're wheeling around your head in a bat flight on the way out of the cave to feed at night. But at the same time, cavers everywhere have a deep respect for bats because being in close proximity with them all the time, we've studied them and learned that they're really beneficial to the environment. And they've been persecuted for a long time. And so cavers will go out of their ways to preserve bats, to avoid caves where threatened bats live, or to avoid caves where there's nursery colonies where the bats are hibernating. The cave I wrote about with the 40,000 bats screaming around me was in the tropics in Jamaica, and the bats were not hibernating. They were not a threatened species, and they were in between the group I was with and the passage we hoped to go explore. So there was nothing for it but to plow on through the bats. And these were big tropical bats. Most North American bats, if you know, it's the size of a little mouse with wings. They're tiny little creatures. They couldn't really hurt you if they wanted to in most cases. The tropical bats get a little bit bigger, a little more horror movie-like in terms of the experience. And yet at the same time, it's their environment, and I respect it whenever I'm going through it.
What do the bats contribute to the environment?
Well, many things. Probably the best thing in the U.S., and especially the southeast and southwestern states, is they eat mosquitoes. Bats eat either mosquitoes or fruit, or insects or fruit. The ones who eat insects often show a preponderance to go after mosquitoes. There's a cave in Texas that's featured in the IMAX film. It has a year-round colony of around 20 million bats, and they eat something like 500,000 pounds of mosquitoes every night. So they keep the insect population down. Then there are fruit-eating bats, and like birds and bees, they help pollinate and distribute fruits. If you eat peaches, for example, chances are the peach was pollinated not by an insect but by a bat.
Where there's lots of bats, there's lots of bat guano, which is the word for bat.
Yes, guano is the best natural fertilizer known to man. In fact, I've been known to sometimes bag a little bit of guano whenever I'm on a caving trip and bring it back for the garden because it makes things grow terrifically.
You've also been known to slide down a 6-foot hill of bat guano.
Yeah.
That must be a pretty awful experience.
Well, cavers get dirty. And, you know, cavers, they're a different sort of people. They're often very quirky in their habits. And I think at a base level, it comes down to the fact we're like little kids playing in the sandbox. If you want to find the big room, sometimes you have to go through the little muddy places to get to them. So this was on another tropical caving trip. I sledded down a big hill of guano because there was an opening at the base of it, and it was too slick to do anything but slide down it. So I'm covered with slime at the bottom, but there's a little opening, and I feel some air coming out of it, and it's kind of tight, but I can wiggle through, and there's a room on the other side. It just keeps pulling us forward.
Did you ever get caught in a narrow opening?
Yes, I did. Most cavers are very light, small people. My wife describes a lot of my friends as kind of squirrel-like. I am not squirrel-like. I'm about as big as cavers come. I've got a big frame, and there's a passage in West Virginia. It's in a cave called Bone Cave, and Bone Cave connects to Norman Cave in one spot through a squeeze called the Devil's Pinch, and it's got a knife blade of rock running down the center of what's a very tight squeeze. And I went one way from Bone Cave into Norman Cave through it. I'd heard people larger than me had gone through and fit fine. And it was very hard, but by exhaling so that my rib cage got smaller, I could slither through and pop out on the other side. And then we spent a number of hours in the cave on the other side. But coming back, which we had to do because we didn't know the way to the other entrance to the cave that was on the Norman side, something about the angle was just difficult. I couldn't align my body the way I had going through the other direction. And I pushed forward, and I couldn't go any further. And this is the way out of the cave, so I've got to go. So I backed up. I took off my coveralls and passed my coveralls and my pack up to a friend on the other side of the constriction. And so I'm sliding up basically in my underwear, and this blade of rock starts digging into my chest. So I exhale and squeeze forward on my, use my toes and fingers to pull forward. And then I can inhale just about a half inch before my chest is caught on the rock. And eventually I squeeze forward to the point where I literally could not inhale anymore. No breath. I'm stuck in the rock, but I'm within an inch of getting out, and I know it. And I just stuck my hand forward and got a friend to yank from the other side, and he popped me past the constriction. I had a cut on my chest, but I was through. That's the tightest spot I've ever been. I've heard other cavers talk about going into similarly tight places. You have to know by practicing on the surface with a box, this thing called a squeeze box. We test ourselves. We know what's the smallest spot we can fit through, and you shouldn't try to push anything smaller than that.
Michael Ray Taylor is the author of Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms. This is Fresh Air. I don't know about you, but I've never given a lot of thought to caves. So I'm grateful to Michael Ray Taylor for describing how exotic and interesting they are. That reminds me of something that I think is important about public radio. It examines the world you know you're interested in, but also presents you with ideas, places, and issues that you haven't thought about, but are grateful you found out about. That's one of the many reasons your station is worth supporting. Please call with a pledge. Thank you. My guest is Michael Ray Taylor, and he's a caver who is also a journalist and has written a lot about caves. His latest book is called Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms, and it's a companion to an IMAX film called Journey into Amazing Caves. Part of your new book is about ice caves. Would you describe an ice cave that you've visited?
Well, ice caves are very different from what we think of as the more traditional caves in rock because they are so temporary. A cave like Mammoth Cave or Carlsbad Caverns, it's a geological feature that took millions of years to form, and it's not going anywhere anytime soon. Ice caves are ephemeral. They form in glaciers. Glaciers are moving, breathing. When you're inside an ice cave, you can often hear the glacier groaning as it's slowly sliding down the rock beneath it toward the sea. And so ice caves give you sort of a fast-forward view of geology. They take water, runoff water, melt water from the surface. They channel it down toward the bedrock, just as traditional caves channel water from the surface through porous rock. But they're unstable. The vertical shafts in ice cave, and you can see this marvelously in the IMAX film, tend to be among the most dangerous types of vertical caving you can do because big chunks of ice are liable to fall without any warning. This doesn't happen or doesn't happen very often at all in a cave in rock. Hollywood will often show as soon as a group of people in a Hollywood film go into a cave, the ceiling starts falling in. Well, cavers laugh at that because the ceiling in your local mall is more likely to fall in than most caves, which have been there thousands of years. But when you're inside ice, you have to watch every step. You have to anchor yourself to the wall at all times, and sometimes you'll swing a hammer to set an anchor, and a crack will appear like a gunshot that runs for 100 feet, and you'll feel everything shift a little bit. This, in fact, happened to the IMAX crew when they were getting one of the scenes in the movie. They had a camera crew of three people balanced on a block of ice 60 feet off the floor of a 500-foot pit, and this whole block of ice, which was the size of maybe two school buses, without warning, shifted. It only shifted an inch. For a moment, they thought they were just going to crash to their deaths. Luckily, it wasn't shifting any more than that, but they still got out of there very quickly after that.
What are some of the strangest things you found within caves?
Oh, probably what I would call strangest are the things that are not indigenous to the cave, things that have been brought in by other people somehow. I was with a friend in Tennessee one time. We were exploring some pits on a particular mountain that had a number of pits on it. There was this one pit about 130, 140 feet deep. We rappelled to the bottom, and there's a small circular room at the bottom of the pit, and arranged around the perimeter of the room were all these horse skulls, and each one had a black candle melted on top of it. It was like a scene from a horror movie or an AC/DC video, and it creeped us out a little bit. Every once in a while, you come up with something incongruous, an old car that someone has somehow abandoned in a cave miles from any road. But in terms of the natural features of the cave, to me, they're just, I'm excited. I find them wonderful, but it's the excitement one gets from watching birds or walking through a national forest.
When you resurface to the outside world after exploring a cave, how does that world look different to you?
Well, it's most noticeable after a lengthy trip. In the course of doing some of the research on cave microbes, I did a couple of trips into Lechuguilla Cave that lasted 3 days or more. And after several days underground, where the colors you see are various hues of red and orange and just the dull brown earth colors, to get up on the surface world in the New Mexico desert, suddenly the blue looks a lot more blue, the green looks a lot more green. It's a kind of a rebirth. I suppose this is another reason caves were important to so many early societies, that they were symbolic of the act of birth itself. And that's the way you feel when you come out of a cave, changed and as if you've been to a place no one else will know, and your life is very much enriched by that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about caves.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Michael Ray Taylor's latest book is called Caves, Exploring Hidden Realms. It's the companion book to the new IMAX movie, Journey into Amazing Caves. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The dread of home sent journalist Richard Bernstein off on a journey. Coming up, Bernstein, New York Times book critic and former foreign correspondent, tells us about his journey retracing the path of a 7th century Buddhist monk through China and India and how it transformed him. It's the subject of Bernstein's new book.
Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, with safety features including the active head restraint, front and side airbags, and OnStar, all standard equipment. Information available at saabusa.com. And from Nonesuch Records and soprano Dawn Upshaw's release, Angels Hide Their Faces, featuring music of Bach and Purcell, available at Barnes & Noble music locations.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You may know my guest Richard Bernstein as a New York Times book critic, former foreign correspondent, and Time magazine's first Beijing bureau chief. After he turned 50, living in New York, he wanted to get away from it all. He decided to retrace the journey of the 7th century Chinese Buddhist monk Xuan Zhang. The monk traveled 5,000 miles from China's ancient capital to southern India in search of the original Sanskrit Buddhist texts. His goal was to produce new translations of these classic texts, to develop a purer form of Chinese Buddhism, and in the process, to achieve the exalted understanding that was the ultimate truth. The monk's journey took 17 years. Bernstein's took about 4 months. His new book about both journeys is called Ultimate Journey. I asked Richard Bernstein to tell us more about what the monk was searching for.
I mean, he was after trying to resolve a paradox that's very central to his version of Buddhism, which was a very intellectual kind of Buddhism called Yogacara, the mind-only school of Buddhism, which holds that everything that we perceive is a creation of the mind. There is no distinction between the mind and the world outside the mind that it perceives. But the paradox then comes in the idea that, in other words, how do you create a sense that the world as you perceive it is empty, and resolve the idea that that emptiness doesn't apply also to the concept that you've applied to the world. As I say, I use the concept, I try to use a very modern day metaphor to understand the problem here, maybe not the solution, but the problem. I talk about the yellow submarine by the Beatles, where there's a vacuum cleaner that sucks up everything in sight. And then once it's done that, it turns on itself and it sucks itself down. So one is the idea that the world is illusion, and then the idea that the world is an illusion is also an illusion when the vacuum cleaner sucks itself into non-existence also.
Richard Bernstein, you describe yourself as a secular Jew. What was your interest in Buddhism as someone who is Jewish but doesn't really believe in God?
Well, that's part of the appeal of Buddhism. I think you don't need to believe in God in order to find Buddhism appealing. And I didn't become a Buddhist, by the way. I mean, I'm still a Jew in the, you know, kind of secular, historical, cultural sense of that word Jew. But as I traveled, I gained a tremendous reverence for Buddhism and for, you know, this idea that there really is this thing that we call the wisdom of the East. And Buddhism, I think, embodies it or embodies some of that wisdom with tremendous brilliance. I mean, the concept of emptiness and the idea that all is an illusion and the idea that how do we know that what we perceive through our senses is real? These are ideas that don't get considered in the West until 1,000 years later with Descartes and the British empirical philosophers. And yet here you have, actually well before Xuanzang in India in the 4th century, you have people embarking on a very penetrating examination of that idea.
Let's talk more about your reasons for taking this trip. You're a book critic, and you say you were experiencing a quarrel with bourgeois life. What was your quarrel?
Right. You know, I remember one time I came home from being a foreign correspondent for a few years, and the night that I arrived back in New York, I was staying at the New York Times apartment, and I wanted to go out and buy some breakfast food for the next day. And I went into the supermarket, and I felt just tremendously depressed by all that sort of odorless, shrink-wrapped, packaged stuff that you had in the American supermarket. And I longed for the markets of Asia, where, you know, you can still smell everything, where there's just a kind of a color. There's the smell of blood and of death in the market, as well as of life. And I miss that. I miss the adventure of roaming around the world, of being someplace else. And I guess I found that, well, I have a good life and an interesting job, and I enjoy it and I appreciate it, that I had kind of stopped adventuring a little bit too early. I felt that I had crossed over the border of 50 years old, and I wasn't, life wasn't as exciting as I wanted it to be.
Well, the woman who is now your wife, who was your lover at the time of the trip, is from China. She's a woman who was a very well-known dancer in China and had come to the United States in the hopes of dancing here. And she, Zheng Mei is her name, went to China with you for the first part of the journey and helped you kind of finesse things. Part of your trouble was that you were having problems getting travel documents. What was the problem?
Well, the problem was that I've been a journalist in China before, which already put me in, I guess, not the best, most favorable light in, from the standpoint of the Chinese authorities. And then in 1996, with Ross H. Munro, I wrote a book called The Coming Conflict with China, after which I found myself declared public enemy number one in China for a while and unable to get a visa. I tried for several years, actually, to get a visa to go and make this trip, and I got turned down. The American Embassy in Peking tried to persuade the Chinese authorities that this was a good project and that wouldn't reflect badly on China, which is true, it doesn't. But I still wasn't able to get a visa. And finally, I just went to Hong Kong to a travel agent, and I got a tourist visa that you get in Hong Kong sort of through sort of semi-official channels. But it looks a little bit different from a regular visa. And journalists, in any case, are banned from most of the stretch that I had to travel in China. So Zheng Mei went to be there in Xi'an, my point of arrival, to see what she could do if, in fact, I got turned back at the border or they slapped me in irons or tried to deport me right away. She was there with letters of introduction and so forth and wanted to help. And then she stayed with me for the first couple of weeks as I traveled in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, the very westernmost, huge westernmost province of China that really is where the old traditional Silk Road goes.
When you were recrossing the path of Xuanzang, the ancient Buddhist monk from the 7th century, the most remote part of your trip, the most remote part was in Taklamakan. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You're pronouncing it properly. Well, the Taklamakan is the great western desert of China.
And you're right that this is as remote as it's possible to be and still be on the planet. What mm-hmm. gave it that feeling of remoteness, of differentness?
Oh, it's just its vastness, its flatness, its the sheerness of it, the way the air and the earth glitter together in such a way that you really can't even make out exactly where one begins and the other ends. I mean, Zheng Mei and I, until she had to peel off and come back to the United States, went on the northern oasis route, which is more highly populated than the southern route. But on the way back, I took the southern route, and I hired a jeep and a driver. And I mean, there were stretches where you would go for 10 or 12 hours down these sandy roads, and you wouldn't pass a single car coming in the other direction. So it is really the Platonic ideal of remoteness, of barrenness and farawayness.
So when you were going through this vast desert, you were reflecting on the nature of your trip. You were thinking about Buddhism and so on. Were you scared at all? Were you thinking about water? Were you thinking about what if the jeep breaks?
I wasn't scared so much along those lines. I was nervous in that part of the trip about getting found out by the Chinese authorities and being captured, as it were, and sent home before I could finish the journey. Actually, at that point, before the journey had really even gotten started, so I I took a very low profile. I actually can handle Chinese fairly well from my years living in Asia and China, but I pretended not to be able to understand or to speak Chinese so as not to draw any suspicion to myself. One time I was having noodles in a noodle shop, and I made the mistake of taking out my notebook and writing down some notes, and I found the man in the noodle shop accusing me of being a spy. And then I worried about him going off to the police of the local town, which is called Jiayuguan, and telling them about this suspicious guy who was writing notes in a notebook while eating noodles. And then shortly after that, I looked at the very westernmost remnant of the Great Wall, which is in this place, Jiayuguan. And as I climbed up to the top of the wall, I saw three uniformed men sort of climbing up the wall in my direction. And I was terrified that they were policemen who had been informed by the man in the restaurant and they were coming to get me. But in fact, they just sort of started posing for pictures and taking snapshots of each other. So there was that danger passed.
It's funny how something that's the most natural thing in the world to you, sitting in a restaurant and taking some notes, just writing things down, is a sign of something awful when you're an American in China.
Well, I think actually there's even some political meaning. I didn't go in order to find out the political situation so much, but I was there when the United States accidentally, I suppose, bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade. And it was amazing how from one moment to the next, the atmosphere in China changed and how the propaganda machinery went into operation to create this intense mood of anger, animosity, fury at the United States and these sort of nationwide calls for China to be strong, to avenge the deaths of those who had died in the Belgrade embassy. In a way, there was a connection between that guy the man in the restaurant happened before the bombing of Belgrade. But that kind of touchiness in the face of American intruders is something that you encounter in China, even as at the same time you encounter basically a very welcoming a picture. People are very enthusiastic. And by the way, during the entire trip, I never did get stopped by a policeman, which in itself is kind of amazing if you think about the tensions in that part of the world, the fact that I am an American, that that when I was in China, I left China 18 years ago, and I went to Xinjiang in 1982, and you couldn't talk to somebody without having your minder present, supervising your conversation. You couldn't go any place without being accompanied by a representative of the Chinese government. And here I was able to go to all of these places, to the very border with China and Kyrgyzstan, and to cross the border without ever being stopped or questioned about who I was or what I was up to.
My guest is Richard Bernstein, author of the new book, Ultimate Journey. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Bernstein. He's a book critic for The New York Times, a former Times foreign correspondent. Now he's written a new book called Ultimate Journey about his journey in which he retraced the route of a 7th century Buddhist monk who had gone in search of the ultimate truth. What was the moment of your trip where you most felt, yes, this is the reason to take a voyage like this?
Oh, there were a number of of moments like that. I suppose when I met a man, the Shankaracharya of Kanchipuram, the spiritual leader of 800 million Hindus, and I sat with him. I was received very cordially by him, and I sat with him in a room, a very bare room, sitting on the floor. Supposedly his only possession is a wooden bowl. And I thought that he was so different from me that there's really almost no way that he and I are going to make a connection. And yet we did make a connection, and we spoke. He spoke to me about Hindu philosophy. We spoke about Judaism. We talked about the renunciation of the self. And he was so eloquent and so charming and so intelligent that I really did have the feeling that the whole trip was worth just this moment of meeting this man.
You write in your book about your really ambivalent feelings about home. You say you feel the sense of unease at the idea of home. And on the one hand, you feel like home is good, and on the other hand, you feel home is horrible. What is it that makes you so ambivalent about home, do you think? What do you dread about the sense of home?
I guess I dread the routine of home and the ordinariness of it, the fact that you grow old when you're at home. I remember talking about saying something in the book about how when you're traveling, you have at least the illusion that that time is not passing because you're so busy that you don't really feel yourself getting old and time passing. Home to me has been the place of comfort and the place of belonging, but it's also the place that can get tedious, where you're too comfortable, where not very much happens. I use the expression the horror of home in this regard, and somebody pointed out after the book was published that actually that's a phrase from Baudelaire. I didn't know it, but I was kind of comforted to know that a poet of that stature had some of these same feelings of ambivalence about home, both as the place that you need, but as the place also that fills your life with a certain kind of lack of adventure, with a certain everything is too ordinary, the prosody of day-to-day existence.
And you spent much of your life, or a good deal of your adult life, in other countries as a foreign correspondent. But in mm-hmm. the past few years, you've been home in New York writing book reviews for the New York Times. You discuss being single and being married in your book. You were single until very recently, until after your trip. You say the Torah calls a man without a wife or without children half a man. Do you believe
yes.
that? Did you think of yourself as half a man before you got married?
Well, I mean, not literally, but yes, I felt very much that by not being married and also by not having children, which I don't have yet, that I was missing out on something very important, both for me personally, but also it gets to this, my sort of the way in which I'm drawn towards a kind of spiritual solace and spiritual meaning and religious meaning, connection with the past and responsibility to the generations of the future. And at the same time that as an unbeliever, I feel somewhat alienated by all of those things. And the trip was a way in which to try to work some of those things out. But marriage was kind of like that for me too. I suppose there was, in a way, if I had a horror of home, I also had a horror of marriage. It was where, you know, you gave yourself a kind of final definition, and it seemed to me, in my mind, and I feared it. And at the same time, yes, I felt that you have some kind of a responsibility to live for something just beyond yourself, to create a next generation, to fulfill what really is a sort of almost, well, it's a biblical injunction to, you know, the Jews call it to be, you know, to be fruitful and multiply. And I had, instead of being fruitful and multiplied, I had always chosen this life of splendid isolation and solitude. And so, yes, in that sense, I did feel that I was half a man, half a person.
Instead of being fruitful, you were productive. You got a lot of work done.
That I did, yeah.
So what exactly changed on the trip that made you emerge as somebody who's really ready to get married? Part of it was, I think, that you spent more time with the woman who became your wife because she traveled with you on the first and final legs of the journey. But what changed in you that kind of opened your mind to actually making a commitment to have a partner and also have a home?
Well, the first part of it is important. Jung-mei, my wife now, my girlfriend in those days, and I really had a tremendous experience together. And there was a moment, really, this is almost an epiphany, when she peeled off to come back to the States, and she brought me to the train station in Kucha, in western China, at about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was still dark, and she put me on the train and said goodbye to me in the on the platform, and turned around and walked away. And as I went off through the desert, and especially on an almost overnight bus ride, I sort of thought of myself going in one direction, and I thought of her on the train going in the other direction. And I did have a kind of epiphany that this was ridiculous. We shouldn't be going in opposite directions anymore. And that if she'll have me, I want to be going in the same direction as her from now on. And then there was, I don't know, I got something very important for me out of my system. I did it. I did sort of overcome my inertia. I shook things up. I just felt happier. I felt more comfortable with myself for having had this adventure, for having traced this man's journey, for having thought about Buddhism and the concepts that Buddhism brings into your life about the renunciation of the self, about you learn how, again, to strip yourself down a little bit and focus on the essential things, and to be content rather than chronically dissatisfied.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Richard Bernstein is a New York Times book critic and author of the new book, Ultimate Journey. This is Fresh Air. We often talk about religion on Fresh Air, not to convert you and not to try to prove one religion superior to another, but to understand and compare their different approaches to understanding the meaning of life. This type of reflective conversation is possible because we're listener-supported. And now is the time when we need to ask you for your support. I hope you'll call with a pledge. Thank you. Kate Wolbert has attracted attention for her short stories. In fact, her debut novel, The Gardens of Kyoto, is based on one of her short stories that won a Pushcart and an O. Henry Prize. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that, like O. Henry, Wolbert has a literary knack for sad surprises.
There's an arrestingly wistful atmosphere to Kate Wolbert's first novel, The Gardens of Kyoto. Like so many other American novels, consciously or not, hers looks to the American novel, The Great Gatsby, for inspiration. In this case, Nick Carraway's signature tone of regret is transposed to the voice of a middle-aged woman named Ellen, one of three sisters who came of age during World War II. Of course, World War II is a hot subject for books and movies right now. But what's different about Wolbert's small story is that it focuses on the lasting damage done to those who only stand and wait. The women, like Ellen, whose lives were blown to smithereens, either because the men they loved returned as hopelessly damaged goods or never came home at all. In the first paragraph of The Gardens of Kyoto, Ellen abruptly introduces herself by announcing, "I had a cousin, Randall, killed on Iwo Jima. Have I told you? The last man killed on the island," they said. "Killed after the fighting had ceased and the rest of the soldiers had already been transported away to hospitals or to body bags. Killed mopping up. That's what they called it, a mopping up operation." That's what this memorable novel is, too, a decades-long mopping up operation by a woman too weary to notice that she's missing spots, going around in circles, just pushing dust around without really doing any cleaning. Ellen begins her story by telling us about the first time she remembers meeting Randall. It was an Easter visit with her parents and sisters. She and Randall were both teenagers. Randall's mother died young, and he and his father, Sterling, an amateur Jonathan Edwards scholar who shares the great Puritan preacher's gloomy disposition, live in isolation on Maryland's eastern shore in a cavernous house that was once a way station for escaped slaves. On that visit, Randall takes Ellen into the slave's secret hiding hole that he's discovered in the house. Or was that another visit? Readers quickly catch on that Ellen's memory is unreliable, sometimes more wishful than precise. Her hypnotic account of her growing romantic attachment to Randall, who goes off to war while he's still a teenaged beanpole, is interspersed with purely imagined recollections of his mother's life, as well as stories about the famed gardens of Kyoto in Japan, a place that obsessed Randall. By the time the novel ends, readers also catch on to something else, that the entire story is a dramatic monologue structured around three unwanted pregnancies, and Ellen has been declaiming her confessions not to us, but to her most cherished confidant. We readers are only mere eavesdroppers, stand-ins, rubberneckers at the accidents of fate that befall relative strangers. The Gardens of Kyoto contains a few chapters I wish Walbert had weeded out, a life-altering meeting where three important characters lock eyes for the first and only time seems forced, and the section where Ellen remembers her student days in the 1950s at a women's college is the same old, serving up reheated references to polite dating practices and MRS degrees. But there's a whispery, ghostly quality to the novel as a whole that excuses its momentary weaknesses. Towards the end of the story, Ellen, as she frequently does, describes one of the gardens of Kyoto. This one, she says, is meant to be viewed at night, in shadows. The entire thing, the pathways, the fountains, the lakes, the cherry trees, is an illusion. Colorless shadows without scent cast by large paper cutouts. A scene set from a drama created by the emperor's gardeners, specifically to his wishes. Changed for the seasons, rearranged. Bare trees for trees in full bloom, lakes with frothy waves, blossoms far too large to grow in that climate. The image of that particular garden offers a pretty good metaphor for the novel itself. Some parts are obviously fake, but the overall effect is haunting.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Gardens of Kyoto by Kate Walbert. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. This is NPR, National Public Radio. What sound does a car make when it accidentally falls off a lift? On the next Fresh Air, we find out from the car guys, Tom and Ray Maliazzi, host of NPR's Car Talk. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.